You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This conversation was recorded in the summer of 2017. Armando's latest film, The Personal History of David Copperfield, will be released on the 24th of January, 2020.
So, Armando, when people like me can always remember their first ever television job, that's easily done. But lots of people can't remember their second ever television job, but I can, because my second ever television job, and I remember this with incredible, terrifying clarity, was being stuck in a helicopter over the Palace of Versailles, throwing 40 kilos of button mushrooms.
That's right.
And it was your doing.
It was on a Friday night armistice, or maybe it was a Saturday night armistice then.
Friday night.
But you were basically creating a mushroom cloud, I seem to remember.
Of real mushrooms.
It was a literal, actual mushroom cloud. See, in those days, we thought it was funny to take a phrase that was fundamentally a metaphor and then do a kind of, what about if we actually literally did it? And then Ed Miliband came along with his actual carved in stone slab of promises, if you remember.
I do.
And that's when, you know, you just thought, this has gone, politics is now being written by people who think they are as good as sketch writers and as funny as comedians. And sort of, so politics is done in the shape of a joke, but, you know, to make it look like they're human, but it's not funny.
No, because it's having a real impact on real people.
Because actual people literally die as a consequence of some of these decisions.
But those are sort of the halcyon days in that there was, satire was possible because the people, I mean, it seems to me at that time with Friday Night Armistice, Saturday Night Armistice, that, and with so much of your much, much earlier work, I take you right back to Radio Scotland where you were talking about the poll tax. It was issue-based satire.
There was issues, yes. And also being plugged into the BBC, which at the time hadn't sold off all its different departments, costumes and whatever. Yeah. We were allowed in the Friday Night Armistice, we were allowed to basically run around Television Centre and all its departments and muck about with other shows, borrow. I think I stole David Dimbleby's notes from his live election special at one point.
Did you?
Yes. But it was all, you know, arranged.
Yes.
Because we did. In fact, we had Sally Phillips in a helicopter in the election special.
What was it about you in helicopters? You were trying to kill all of your female...
She was a whore in a helicopter.
She was.
Who was going to land at the first... When the first result came in, she was going to land in that MP...
Was she called the whore in the sky?
The heli whore, I think. And... I mean, it's all slightly unsavoury now that I think about it.
It is. Now it's heli sex worker.
Yeah, I know.
Otherwise,
exactly,
we're damned to hell.
Heli person.
Heli. Exactly. Whose job happens to
be... Non-gender specific person.
Non-binary.
With a job that in many other cultures could be deemed as one that she's forced upon to do in order to generate income for her family.
In a helicopter.
And, yeah. What was the point again? Real issues, as you say.
Real issues. Did you yourself ever get into a helicopter, or did you just force other people to do it in the name of satire?
No, but I remember the very first bit of television I made. It was in the day-to-day, and again, it involved a helicopter. I don't know what it is about me with helicopters, because it was for the day-to-day.
Yeah.
And in the pilot of the day-to-day, we did this sort of spoof of 999, the Michael Burke thing, that involved a shepherd and his dog in a helicopter, and the shepherd passing out. So
that's right. The collie.
So other shepherds were called into the control tower to whistle instructions to the dog to pilot the helicopter down. But in the way that 999 does this, what they didn't know was that a fire was in the back of the barge. You know, all these other crises. What we thought was that this helicopter was heading towards a field of children. But this was in the days before CGI was cheap. So we actually literally had to book literal actual children and then fly a helicopter.
Buzz them.
But towards it. And I remember the producer of the show, dear Peter Fincham, who ran Talkback, and he was the producer on it, and he went on to run BBC One and ITV and so on. But I remember him just watching us fly a helicopter at children, and just I remember him just turning away, looking like he was going to throw up, because obviously it was like not what he'd signed up to do, really.
I mean, the more we talk,
it's about helicopters. I don't know.
It's a theme in your work.
And then I remember once being in a helicopter.
So you have been in one?
I have now been in a helicopter, and it was great fun. I love heights, actually. Love heights.
Oh, I don't love heights.
I couldn't, like, do the parachute thing, because that's... I love heights, but I hate having no surface beneath my feet. So I couldn't do the parachute. But I love being high up, actually.
I just remember from that mushroom throwing gig, two things. The director, the magnificent Steve Benderlach, who was in the back, crying. He was terrified of flying.
Oh, no.
He was crying down my... So I had these big cans on, you know, and I could just hear him going, oh, God, throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
And then I remember this huge bag of mushrooms in a rather unwieldy kind of bin liner.
Yeah.
And the French pilot really calmly saying, if one of those mushrooms touch the propeller, we all die. And I kept thinking to myself, surely if one mushroom touches a propeller, you'll just have sliced mushrooms. We will all die.
That'd be a great funeral, though, remembering Sue Perkins, who last week died when a mushroom got in the propeller of a helicopter. And everyone just trying not to laugh.
We touched briefly on the idea of satire not being over, but being in a very different, we're in a very different world.
Yeah.
Do you feel slightly, not responsible, but certainly your satire was so acute and so brilliant that you made the monstrous funny and almost acceptable? I'm thinking of Malcolm Tucker.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the reason why I stopped that and Peter going on to be Doctor Who. It was probably very difficult for him to play both roles. but it was when, you know, bits of Thick of It start getting quoted in the House of Commons, but also when you actually find out that people going into politics, these sort of backroom enforcers and spin doctors, actually modelling themselves in Malcolm and seeing Malcolm as a kind of a hero, that I thought, no, something's not right here. This shouldn't happen. This, you know, don't you see that this is meant to be indicating what's
a bad
wrong?
Person.
Yeah, this is wrong. This is what's wrong with politics. This is why people are put off by politics. That sort of spinmeister attitude. But I reject your accusation.
It was a provocation
that I'm responsible for. I mean, I think people genuinely are put off by politics, but the Thick of It was really an attempt to portray, after a good deal of research, what actually goes on. So all I was showing was what goes on. And it was Bismarck, was it not, who said that there are two things you don't want to know what goes on inside: sausages and politics.
That's a great quote.
You know, and it's that. It's... And it was inspired by Yes Minister, which, although it was a very traditional sitcom, you can see the scenery wobble, it's all shouted theatrically to a studio audience, still very much was the very first time we in Britain got an insight into what really genuinely went on in Whitehall, partly because the writers actually had, not leaks, but people from behind the scenes in politics coming to them with stories of what really went on. And Thick of It was a sort of updated version of that approach, is taking stuff that does happen. And then you play with it and you exaggerate it. And occasionally you come up with stuff of your own that you think is even far more outlandish than anything you've ever heard. And then a politician afterwards will come up to you and say, how did you find that out? We kept that quiet. Who told you that? You know, and which is testimony to the fact that it's true. And I think there's nothing wrong in revealing stuff that's true. And I, if, to the politicians who say you've put people off politics, I say, well, no. I mean, I'm showing you what politics was like.
Yeah.
It's up to you to demonstrate that it's no longer like that.
That's very true.
And what I'm finding is that it's in many ways, it's worse. It's kind of ground down to a... Nobody wants to debate anymore. I mean, everything is reduced to just very basic slogans like, you know, we need a strong mandate to...
Strong and stable.
Strong and stable. Coalition of chaos and all that sort of
thing. Red, white and blue Brexit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a sort of psychobabble that your characters perfected and made brilliant and funny in the national imagination, and now it's real and it's not funny
anymore. And I actually that's why I found politically I kind of don't feel that I want to write another comedy about politics now. I actually just want to write about politics now. Do you know what I mean? Fine, if you happen to be funny in the process, fine, but I'm so annoyed by what's going on, but also really concerned that especially younger voters aren't participating in politics. You know, we're sort of disenfranchising ourselves from that conversation. You know, the number of people who vote has been going down drastically since the 1950. Round about then, 90% of people would vote, and fundamentally, you know, 90% of those would vote for the two main parties. Mm. But now it's sort of 67% of people vote. And the two main parties, if we have main parties anymore, it's about 60% of that electorate who votes. So the and yet whoever wins gets total control.
Yes.
So you're reaching a stage where fewer and fewer people are voting for a party that then has absolute power. And that's why people get frustrated and angry, but also disenchanted.
Fear of the other, in whatever form that takes,
yes.
Whether it's people from over there coming over here, or, you know, dirty doctors who can't be bothered to work 7 days a week, you know, whilst taking busy time out from their schedule going to food banks, you know, but there is that sense, isn't it? You're either with us, whatever us means, or you're an enemy of the state.
Yes.
And I've never heard that rhetoric in this country before.
No, it was something that's, I've heard it, it's been growing and growing in America, especially from the Republicans, in that the Republicans, when they were in opposition, I mean, it's different now that they're in control. Now it's like government's very hard and please bear with us. But when they were in opposition, it was like whenever anyone voted for a Democrat president, the Republican argument was, but that's unconstitutional. You know, to disagree with us is tantamount to just being wrong.
Yeah,
it's scientifically wrong. And when I was researching In the Loop, which is a film about Britain and America joining forces to invade another country, and I went out and did this research, they talked about the neocons under George W. Bush, the Rumsfelds of this world, who genuinely did believe that if you disagreed with them, it was actually not worth our while continuing the argument, you know, because you had shown that you were an idiot. And by disagreeing with them. And therefore, what's the point? There's no point engaging in any kind of conversation with an idiot because it's just not going to go in.
And yet this is from the man who came up with known knowns and known unknowns.
No unknowns.
So, I mean, as you say, you spent years, 4.5 years doing making Veep.
Yeah.
Did you see in all that time when you were, you know, presumably in the same way that you did with the thick of it, getting intel from inside the White House and from senior level officials. Did you see the sea change coming? Did you know that Trump was inevitable by the time you left?
No, I have to say I didn't see Trump coming. But what I did feel at the time was that the whole thing was gridlocked. The American Constitution is predicated on the fact that no one branch of government has total power and that therefore decisions can only be made by compromise.
Yes.
That's the whole point of it, that the House of Representatives and the Senate have to, in the end, agree on legislation between them, that in the end, the Senate has a 60-40 threshold that will require members of the opposition to join in and therefore require the majority side to make some compromises. It only works if there's compromises. But what happened was about 10 or 15 years ago, they decided not to speak to each other. they set up these separate camps, and it was either and they defined themselves by the legislation they prevented from happening. You know, we stop this from happening. We'll say no to this. We're going to pull out of that. You know, and that's how they define. And I could see that because they weren't speaking to each other, nothing really was getting done.
Yeah.
And that spelt trouble. And it felt a bit like, you know, the end of the Roman Empire. This one glorious kind of peacekeeper, the Pax Romana, the civilized world was at its absolute height of, and then just starting to crumble and cracks appearing in it. It got too big, too unwieldy, too many different groups that couldn't quite come together, and, you know, and it started to fall apart. Now, it took the Roman Empire about 200 years to fall apart, really.
How long's America got, do you think?
Well, yeah, exactly. But everything is so accelerated now, you know, so I give it 4 months.
That's an extreme prognosis. The leader of the free world is going to destroy his own country within 4 months.
Yeah.
Is it true, by the way, that when you were researching Veep, you got it? I don't think it was the White House, but you just breezed in somewhere saying that you were there for a 12:30 appointment.
Yeah, it was the State Department.
And you just, I mean, it's unthinkable now with the level of security and vigilance.
No, this would be, it was, when was it? So it was about 2009. So, yes, it was post 9/11.
Yeah.
Somebody said, a journalist from a Washington paper said, oh, just show them your BBC pass and say you're here for the 12:30. And my BBC pass is probably the same now at the BBC. It was just my face. It was just a photo with the words BBC, you know, that a child could have pressed
with
F1.
A hint of lamination,
you know,
but not,
just, that's it. That and on a lanyard.
Yeah, that's enough.
A lanyard. Honestly, ISIS. And also, to be for balance, those against ISIS. If you want to enter buildings, a lanyard is your secret weapon.
It's true.
Yeah. So I kind of went up and said, I'm Andy Ucci, BBC, I'm here for the 12:30, and they waved me through. And I ended up sort of wandering around the State Department.
And this was for what? So why did you want to get in there?
This was for, because I wanted to see what it physically looked like for our art department, because we were going to build the State Department for In the Loop. And for that reason, I thought, well, I might as well take photos. So I was sort of taking these photos thinking, well,
soon something is going to happen.
Interesting, but it is also, I'm technically committing international espionage here.
Yes. So,
and then some big guy did turn up and go, excuse me. And I said, I was with my assistant, Sean. I said, we're here for the 12:30. And he went, well, it's just over there. And so we went into the 12:30, which was Condoleezza Rice's press briefing. It was her press.
You were right up close with Condoleezza.
Her press spokesman. It was a daily briefing. Very dull.
Very dull.
But I then told this story when In the Loop came out, and Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State then, and she ordered a full review of security at the State Department as a result. So as a result, she wasn't killed and therefore stood as a Democrat candidate against Donald Trump and lost. So in effect, yes, I am responsible for Donald Trump.
There's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders just in this brief time.
No, I think about it. Yeah.
But I love the fact that you still do that level of research and that you haven't passed it on to other people.
Yeah, because I've just finished this film called The Death of Stalin, and, you know, it was great. We went round the Kremlin. Of course we went round Stalin.
Did you breeze in there with a BBC lanyard going on, I'm here for 12:30?
There was, somebody said, the Lubyanka prison, which used to be the kind of the KGB's kind of, where people who were rounded up by Stalin were interrogated and shot, and still is the headquarters of the security force. So, they wouldn't let you into it, but somebody said you can see it from, there's a sort of review platform, viewing platform at the top of a big toy department, multi-story toy store in the sort of middle of sort of Moscow shopping center.
So it's like looking at Guantanamo from Hamleys.
Yeah, exactly. So we went up to the top of, and actually what had happened was the side of the viewing platform that looked into over Lubyanka had a big sort of plasterboard partition, so you couldn't actually see. However, there was a tiny triangular gap where the, you know, the wall and the plasterboard didn't quite meet. There was a gap. So I went and looked through the gap. And then as I sort of stretched back up, there was, from nowhere, there was a guy in a suit and dark tie and dark glasses who suddenly materialised in front and just went, no. No.
That's all you need.
And I just went, okay.
Yeah, understood.
And wandered away.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service, delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners from scratch. Perfect for anyone who doesn't have time to prepare their own meals or just isn't very good at cooking. You get to choose your favourites from 19 recipes every week, including rapid recipes which will be ready in 20 minutes or less. They offer family favourites as well as British and world cuisine, including Thai-style sticky pork and penne ragu al forno. Well, this week I made the chili non carne with zesty rice, a spicy vegetarian option that was perfect for a cold winter evening. It's flexible, so you can change the size of your delivery as well as when and where you want it delivered. To sign up for your first box, head to hellofresh.co.uk, choose a box, a delivery slot, and add your favourite recipes. All their fresh ingredients come direct from suppliers, pre-portioned, so there's no food waste. There's also a great selection of veggie options. HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off four boxes. Visit www.hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code OUR at the checkout to enjoy delicious dinners without the drama.
It interests me that that's... So the film about Stalinism, you've written about and created bogeymans, political bogeymen. And this is now about the death of one of the biggest. This is sort of, this is after the damaging man has done his worst.
Yes,
in history, and so it's set in what, 53. So Stalin is now
53. Yes, yeah. And it takes place. Stalin has a stroke and then dies, and then there's the funeral. And it's really about the power struggle. It's really about what happens when people live in terror all the time, are just afraid to say the wrong thing, because if you. You know, for 20 years, if you said a joke about Stalin and somebody reported it, you could be shot. If you were having a cup of tea with a neighbour and you put your mug down accidentally on a photo of Stalin in the newspaper, that neighbour could report you and you could be taken away. You know, it was that desperate. So what happens when that person goes, when he disappears, you know, when he dies, and the power struggle that goes on between Khrushchev, played by Steve Buscemi, and... Beria, the sort of the head of the security, played by Simon Russell Beale, is that kind of power struggle. But also, do you then start? And there's a whole element of it is about, do we just rewrite history? Do we say that the things that used to happen now didn't happen, and the things that we used to say were wrong are now fine, and baddies reinventing themselves as goodies, and goodies trying to outdo the baddies by doing bad things. And there's a lot of, I mean, we filmed this. Last summer, so it was pre-Trump, but there's a lot of dialogue in it about new narratives and alternative facts and stuff like that. So it's weird. When we started showing it to people, they were talking about how it was strangely
prescient.
It was weird.
But that's the thing, isn't it? By focusing on sometimes completely different areas, you can provide such a kind of cool narrative on what's going on.
Well, I was sort of interested in the idea of the strongman, you know, the kind of the Putin type, and, you know, Erdogan in Turkey, and I suppose now Donald Trump. But at the time, Trump wasn't registering on the radar, really. But this idea of, and there was an element of the Farageist kind of, there's a lot going on in Europe that is strangely reminiscent of like 1930s Europe, you know, and it's frightening. It is frightening.
And is it true that Stalin, who had a stroke, didn't he? And that he was so scared, he didn't even intervene in his...
That's right. And this is in the film. It's a lot of the film's based on true stories. Yeah. He told his guards he didn't want to be disturbed. So when they hear him fall over, they don't want to knock on the door because they don't want to be shot. And it's not a doctor he's called, it's the committee, the Politburo called. And they then spent ages arguing over which doctor to call, because Stalin had a lot of the doctors rounded up because he was suspected them of trying to poison him. So there's that whole dilemma as to... There was a respirator there, but they never used it because it was American. So they thought, well, if people find out we used an American, we might be shot. There's a lot of that going on. it's that thing of like Stalin was killed in the way by his own.
Yeah, hoist by his own.
His own, yeah.
I was never like to say hoist by his own petard because it reminds me too much of Veep, the opening episode.
Oh, right, okay.
Which is a very, for those of you who haven't watched it, a very, very funny set of jokes around the idea of being. Yes, exactly. Because you're so prolific and you have had your fingers in so many of the most brilliant televisual pies of all time. I'm interested in how, what your days are like. How do you structure your work?
In fact, I'm very much a sort of 5 days a week, kind of 10 till 6 kind of person, really. And I mean, you say prolific, I don't feel that I'm prolific. I sort of do one project at a time, but while doing that, kind of developing something so that there's something after that project, I kind of have a vague idea of what the next one is. But I don't, it's still fundamentally, I think, 2 or 3 years between a project and the next one, you know, which is how long it takes to develop and pilot and get something up and running.
But they're all you work very collaboratively. So I mean,
yeah.
You have your hut. So you're in your hut, or
yes,
do you have others in your
actually,
hut?
Actually, no. I have got my hut, but I tend to come into London and on most days, and you know, be working with other people. And actually, collaborating, I find, is much easier than sitting on your own and writing. You know, it's like, it's human contact, but it's also you push, if you're working with someone else or a group of people, you're all pushing each other into areas that you wouldn't otherwise have gone to.
Yeah.
Or if you did get there, it would have taken you slightly longer to get there on your own. So I find it a very efficient way of working. And it also allows you, because there are other voices, allows you to be surprised. That's the thing. You can't, when you're writing your own, you don't actually surprise yourself. You know, you write your voice. But what's nice collaborating is that you're writing the voice of the show. But it does mean that other people will genuinely surprise you with stuff that you wouldn't have thought of yourself.
I always think that you worked instinctively in a way that was very unusual at the time, in that you were almost the showrunner, and then you would have writers who would. I'm thinking of Ian Martin, who provided a lot of the.
The swear consultant.
he of the famous marzipan dildo line.
Yes.
But
which has no swear words in it whatsoever.
No, but so, it's just magnificent.
Somehow that's his first line, actually, that he wrote for us. Because it's at the very start of the first episode of The Thick of It. And all it said in the script was, he's useless. He's absolutely useless. And I said to Ian, he wrote this funny website called Martian.fm, and it was really funny. And I just got in touch with him, said, do you want to, you know, get involved, have a look at our scripts and just add whatever. And his inserts were done in red, so they were very easy to look at on the scripts.
They were furious.
Furious, absolutely bilious. But it was great. So his scripts would arrive and get printed off, and we'd just all gather around his scripts and look for the red bits. And they were really funny. And that was the very first one. He's as useless as a marzipan dildo. And that's when I thought, you've got the job. You start Monday, you know.
So that but it was an organ that sort of happened organically. It wasn't your intention to
no,
to work in that way.
And that's why I kind of like going into doing a show, doing a TV project or a radio or a film. So is actually, it's a solid thing. I've got a very fixed idea of what it should feel like and look like, and roughly what the dynamic of it should be. But on the other hand, I like going into it not knowing precisely what the final content is going to be on a week by week basis, or in a 90-minute, you know, if it's a film. I kind of like that element of, as I say, surprise, being putting something in there that feels absolutely right for that project, but is actually coming. And I always say, you know, in the end, it's all about, how do I do this? Because it's visual, but it's all about the four sides of the screen. It's like what goes in that. And I really don't care what it took to get to that, as long as that's as good as it can be. I don't care if we sweated forever over a scene and then it got cut because somebody in a rehearsal improvised something that was far funnier. You know, and so it's all about getting people on board who aren't proprietorial about, you know, writing stuff and then seeing it get changed or altered, yeah, or someone else adding to it and so on. And also, if it's really good, then everyone gets credit. Everyone gets a credit and benefit from saying they worked on it. So, you know, it's sort of win-win, as long as you go in with that attitude that you're not hung up on. So what you mustn't do, this is more when you're directing, you mustn't think, oh, but on the script, it said that.
Yes.
When you're there on set and you're thinking, well, that's on the script isn't going to work because the location is slightly different. You know, something slightly different tonally has come up as we've rehearsed it. You mustn't get hung up on, you know. And what's good about working on the script is it's the launch pad for then what happens in the rehearsal, which then is the launch pad for what happens in the shoot, which is then the launch pad for what happens in the edit.
You know. So, I mean, you have this incredibly collaborative way of writing, but then, as you've alluded to, you then have all these actors on set and you let them inhabit the characters. You let them, yeah, play around the margins, to improvise. In something like The Thick of It, what percentage of stuff was changed?
It's not a lot. You know, it gets changed in the rehearsal process, but the writers are there and, okay, the writers and myself are suggesting changes as we go along. And in the rehearsal process, new stuff develops, but it can get very long and unwieldy. So what we do is take the kind of the essence of what we found was a kind of new sort of discovery about that scene and then rewrite it. So when you go on set, fundamentally, you're shooting the script. If there's time, or if it feels like the funny thing about this scene is the freneticism, it doesn't really matter what people are saying, it's just the frantic nature of it, I'll get people to say, okay, do it again, but just don't feel you have to hit all the cues spot on. Sometimes you can do stuff like that and the first couple of takes sound really rehearsed,
yes,
spotlessly choreographed, so every line is clear and somehow the energy's gone, and to get the energy back you have to tell them to just bash through it, talk over each other,
especially when you've got that cinema verite kind of documentary, yeah, fly on the wall, yeah, style. It feels very strange when people are observing space between lines,
yeah, and yes, and what usually happens is they do the script again but just in an ever so slightly different order.
Really?
You know, the lines just come out slightly different because somebody suddenly said a line that should be at the very end, but it just feels more natural to say it now. So I'm going to say it now. And then another actor goes, oh, right, he said that now, so I'll say this now. And then another actor, she thinks, okay, right, well, they've gone to that bit, so I'll do this now. And it then suddenly seems, even though it's all scripted, it just suddenly seems like the performances are very, you know, they're brilliant performers, obviously, but it just feels like this is a spontaneous conversation that's happening. Because,
yeah,
people are genuinely thinking of what to say next.
But that's the genius of it. The fact that you could have something that's so intensely crafted, that started out on, started its life on BBC Four, so I'm assuming very little money. But
Nothing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in fact, Rolly Keating, the controller of BBC Four, said, look, we've got this amount of money, what can you do with it? And I kind of worked out we could do 3 half-hour if we found a disused set of offices, some people in suits, and 2 cameras wandering around, and 1 lighting state for the whole thing, and we had like 8 days, which is what we did. We shot sort of 3 episodes in eight days. Yes. I mean, it was frantic. But
normally,
it was great
you do
fun.
What, 1 in 6?
No,
one
I know.
Episode in 6 or 7.
I know. And our page count was like on a daily basis. We got through like 15 or 16 sides a day, and it's so funny because in big movies, in your big Marvel, you know, if you got through 1/2 a side in a day, you're laughing. It's extraordinary.
Would you ever, I'm sure you get asked, but yeah, would you ever make movies that you don't have that intense emotional involvement with, or scripting kind of input?
No, but I mean, I'd quite like to do a big film, not a huge
Captain
like,
America. No. Iron Man.
You know, I used to spend all my money, when I was a kid, I used to spend my money on Marvel comics.
Oh,
so,
I love,
you know,
Marvel
so
comics.
I just collected them all. And then my mum threw them out when I was at university, not realising they're probably worth a fortune.
Gold mine.
I think I had, somebody sent me, Twitter's interesting, because somebody sent me a photo of, I completely forgot, a letter that I wrote that got published in one of the Hulk kind of magazines, you know. Anyway, when I was about 8, so I sent a letter in and it got published. So I loved all that. But I loved when Marvel films actually worked. The first Iron Man and second Captain America was really good. But now I'm just so overwhelmed. There's one every 2 months. I'm kind of, I don't know what to do anymore.
The Fantastic Fabulous Four or whatever they are.
Never quite took off cinematically, did it?
No.
So rebooted so many times.
I'm a big fan of Captain America. And I mean, Iron Man almost now is sort of ironically eating itself, isn't it? There's so much knowing kind of exchanges between him and you, the viewer, that it's sort of losing its way a bit, but I still love it. But I'd love it if you did one of those. It would be so unexpected thing. I know,
but I know that what happens is that the director is there for the first two thirds of it and then is quietly removed while Marvel does edit. What it has to do to make it fit its universe, you know.
And also maybe you'd go mad if, you know, I suspect some of these action scripts are maybe only sort of 20 pages long and they're just, you know, when you do see, you know, a bit of dialogue, it's very sort of hastily put together.
No, but I'd love to do I love the idea of a spy movie or a Hitchcockian sort of suspense, you know, but something that's manageable. And in your kind of voice, so it's not lots of people shouting and swearing.
Yeah,
I do love, you know, watching things like Bourne and some really good chases.
I think
when they're done well, really interesting ones. Or in that first, like the French Connection, the car chase in the French Connection, where they couldn't CGI and they just had basically to drive cars at each other and over people. You know, and I just love all that because when you feel it's real, that's when. And there's an element of comedy, you know, there's a rhythm to these things. There's a kind of musicality or a choreography to them that actually I think writing comedy and writing farce actually lends itself to as well. You know, the awareness of structure and that sort of thing, you know, the reveal, the surprise ending and the selling the dummy and so on. That's all. They're all comic procedures, but they're also what goes on in really well-crafted suspense and horror movies. And
do you like horror movies, Eve?
I quite like horror. I'd quite like.
Are you a bit squeamish? I imagine.
I'm not really.
I'm hugely squeamish.
What I don't like is like really graphic violence. You know, I remember I found the. It's going back a bit, but the Reservoir Dogs, the torture scene in Reservoir Dogs, I found it all unpleasant, really, which I suppose was the idea, but I didn't.
So you won't settle down to a box set of Saw or, you know, Wolf Creek?
No, not that interested, no.
No.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Skillshare, the online learning community for the creator in all of us. Getting out of the rut is easier said than done, especially when you have a busy schedule. Whether you want to learn a new skill or get back into an old passion, Skillshare can help build, fuel, and expand your creative fire. And listeners to this podcast can now get 2 months free when you sign up at skillshare.com/hour. Skillshare have thousands of classes from photography to creative writing and many more. I've just found a beginner's Spanish class which promises to teach me the basics of Spanish in a matter of hours. All the classes are on demand, so you can learn at your own pace and at a time that suits you. Learning new creative skills is a great way to relax from the stress of work and family life. Whatever your creative interests may be, Skillshare will have a class for you. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare and get 2 months free when you sign up at skillshare.com/hour. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. Get started today by heading to skillshare.com/hour. Enjoy.
I know you're a big sort of thriller and suspense man, but I read, I don't know if it's true, one now has to prefix everything with, I don't know if it's true, I read it. Fake news. That you've read all 66 of Agatha Christie's. Because I have read pretty much all.
I can't remember any of them.
No, they're all the same.
I was about 14.
Rich Woman on a Train gets it.
And I haven't picked them up since. I'm intrigued. I might go back and pick one up to think, is it that well written or is it not that well? I don't know.
Because I was saying, it's an ask. When you get to the Tommy and Tuppence stuff, it's a real ask. It's just, there's nothing in you now as an adult that would make you want to return
I haven't read all those. No. It's all the Poirot's read and some of the Marples, but I haven't read all the Tommy and Tuppence stuff.
I've certainly read every Poirot, but I love the idea of the locked room.
Yes.
because it immediately sets the writer a challenge and the reader. How did you get out? Those old classics like Moonstone and I know you're a big Dickens fan. Are you a Wilkie Collins fan, or
I've read some Wilkie Collins, but it's been a while. The next film project is going to be David Copperfield. We're going to do a film of David Copperfield.
This must be a dream come true, because you are really well known as a Dickens fan.
Yeah, but this is like using as much of the dialogue being Dickens' own dialogue in the book, because it is great. He's a fantastic. In fact, Simon Blackwell, who I'm writing it with, he's actually done like a 200-page script version of just the dialogue, and it reads tremendously well.
So he just filleted out the actual dialogue.
Yeah, you just read it and you think, who is this guy? Why hasn't he done more movies? Let's get him in. Let's get him on board. You know, the hard part will be turning it into a 90-minute proper feature with the pace and everything that you, you know, and not getting, but keeping it funny. A lot of David Copperfield has done the adaptations are done very reverentially.
There's a lot of pathos in it.
It's a lot of pathos, and the love story is a bit dull.
Yes,
really,
I agree.
Actually. And a lot of the really funny stuff is from his earlier, or when he's quite a young man making his way in the city and getting drunk for the first time and having friends who don't have any money and then marrying disastrously. I mean, his wife that he marries, who Dickens conveniently just kills off. Yeah. It's the only way to get him out of it. But, you know, that's the really interesting stuff. But for some reason, adaptations are very reverential about it's the older David Copperfield and this love story that's a bit, you know, it's a bit wimpy. And it's a bit. But that's the next thing I want to do cinematically.
Are you ready for the wrath, the inevitable knee-jerk wrath of the Dickens societies?
I think I can deal with those 300 people. Yes.
they're quite full. I did a documentary about Mrs. Dickens.
Oh, right, yes.
And the rather shabby way that she was treated by Charles. That even though it was all factually correct and taken from his own letters at the British Library, they were having none of it.
No. I did a documentary on David Copperfield for the BBC, and I went to the Dickens Museum, and it's not there now. They've redone it, and it's not there. But there is a portrait or a photograph of Dickens for practically every year of his life, so you can watch him grow up, and the portraits of him when he's like one of the world's most famous men, when he's like 20, 21, and he's done Sketch by Boz, and he's done Or Curiosity Shop and Oliver Twist, and internationally renowned. He was like Chaplin in a way.
Yeah, he was the first international celebrity, wasn't he?
Celebrity, and he's still got these like long flowing locks, cherubic, kind of quite sort of beautiful, kind of boyish, kind of angelic. And then you watch him, because he was like quite manic in his energy. You watch him when he hits about 45, his face just collapses and he just ages. In 12 months, he ages by about 20 years. And you can see why he just pegged out at the age of 56 or 58.
And was this when he left his wife and went off with Ellington?
And did all the tours, but was trying to edit a newspaper on a daily basis while bringing out weekly editions of, you know, of Martin Chuzzlewit and Great Expectations and Hard Times. He just took on too much.
He did work himself to death.
But you can see it happening if you look at his photos. How he just suddenly.
I mean, it's he was a performer, though. I'm just thinking back on why his writing can be lifted from the page and put on the screen. He would act it out, wouldn't he? He would famously inhabit these extraordinary characters and talk.
I got a chance to look at his performing copy of Oliver Twist, and he's written in shout, and he's written notes, directions to himself, pathos here, and slow down, so he's got his little actor's notes.
Because he'd do Christmas Carol, wouldn't he? He'd famously tour, and he'd do his Scrooge, and he'd do his, huge performances.
What killed him in the end was going back to America and doing another big tour when he really wasn't well enough, but putting all his energy into very emotional scenes like the death of, who is it in Oliver Twist, who's Sykes.
Yes, Bill Sykes.
Nancy. Yeah. Which is a real, he put all his energy into it. Imagine Brian Blessed.
I do, but all the time.
But in the body of a frail kind of,
He hadn't got the pipes for it anymore, had he, basically?
Imagine Brian Blessed forged with Mackenzie Crook.
He'd just explode.
Exactly.
He'd just be atomised.
Yeah, he'd just shatter.
One bellow, you're right, he'd shatter like glass. But I think it was guilt, though. He basically worked himself to death because he felt, this is my thesis, he felt terribly guilty about what he'd done.
And what about his marriage?
I think so, yeah, about his marriage and his life and his because he behaved badly and just regrets.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
also
the trauma over that train crash and having to keep everything quiet. You know?
Yeah, but also just the profound fear of being poor again. Of the shame of having no money.
Going back to the blacking factory.
And worrying whether... It was almost like he took on all these commitments because he thought, you know, I need the money. And he clearly didn't need the money. But he felt in his head that he did because it might all disappear.
The classic self-employed nightmare, isn't it? It's like, I can't stop. I can't get off the train. I'll never get back on again.
Yeah.
I mean, most people wouldn't necessarily think that that would be your next project. But I think it's... I think. Do you know the one after that? I mean, we know you're fitting in a Marvel. You'll be doing the, you know,
obviously
a Hulk or a.
Yes. Well, I've written a comedy about artificial intelligence as a movie, so I want to.
See, you are prolific. You downplay your prolificness, your prolificosity.
Because I wanted, after doing Veep, I wanted to direct more films, and I spoke to various directors who all said, you know, you've got to have three or four. On the go at once, because the thing about films is they could all fall apart. You know, you're just about ready to start shooting and then, you know, you haven't got the money, or the actor you really want isn't available now for another 6 months or wherever. So you have to have two or three, not absolutely finished, but two or three projects that, so if one goes down, you can then pull out the next one and get on with it until the first one is ready again.
And so what keeps you going? Yeah. The fact that you've done more and already done more than most people will ever do in a lifetime. Well, what drives the engine?
I don't know. I mean, you speak to like a really good teacher, I think.
I speak to really good teachers all the time.
A really good teacher will have changed the lives of many, many people
and doctors will have changed the lives. But within the context of your profession, of what you do.
Yeah.
Why? What keeps you going? What is the thing that gets you to the man shed at 10 a.m. Monday to Friday without
really
fail?
Really, man shed. There are no power drills. No. What gets me to the shed? I don't know. I just an idea that intrigues me. If that pops up, or an area that intrigues me, and then coupled with, have I seen anything? Is there anything that's like it already? Or because I don't want to make something that is treading ground that some other show or film has done.
Yes.
So it's that, really.
But that's hard,
so I do in the end spend a lot of time either saying no to stuff or crossing out ideas and so on.
And is there any time for real life?
Yes, because if you work 10 till 6, 5 days a week, there's evenings and weekends, like most people
have. But what do you do? I only know of you in a sort of work. I mean, sometimes out of work, but you know, work related context.
No, I'm not a kind of showbiz. You know, I don't go off to strip clubs with other comedians. I just go on my own.
They're really good fun. You should join us sometime.
Yeah. It's every Tuesday afternoon, isn't it?
Yeah. Just outside Windsor. You know, yeah. Isn't it? You'll find it.
We don't live in London. We live outside London. And, you know, we have friends outside. You know, I've got friends, usually other writers or performers like Chris Addison or Simon Blackwell, Peter Capaldi, you know, those Fred, David Schneider, friends who work in that. But we also have like loads of friends who are outside that world, who are neighbours or, you know, who you know just through, you know, your kids were at school together, you know, parents from your kids. And I just rather do that. You know, I don't have like a big hobby that takes up all my time outside.
So you don't garden?
No.
You don't rustle up sort of, you know, regional Spanish dishes?
No. I like reading and chatting.
They're good enough.
I've got
hobbies.
A telescope. I like a little bit of astronomy. But the thing about astronomy is it's awfully late. You've got to. The old stars only come out at night.
It's annoying, isn't it?
You know. I think maybe I should get into solar astronomy and just get one of those telescopes that does the sun and be done with it.
Daytime astronomy is so limiting. Really.
It's just the sun, isn't it?
You've got to be
very careful. Looking at into other people's houses.
I was going to say the tilt of the telescope is everything.
No, I'm looking at the sun.
Yeah.
No. I'm sorry, but it is just above your bedroom, just where it is in the sky.
You have to really watch that. Always maintain that. It's got to be up. Pointing up, otherwise.
Yes. So winter is better for astronomy, except it's then cold. Jeez.
But
it's impossible.
Inside. Oh, you need a skylight, and you can be inside looking up.
I've occasionally tried to have hobbies and then got a bit bored. But I don't feel the need in the evenings. I've explored my interests during the day, so I don't come home thinking, I've got to do something to kind of show some interest.
Got to put a shelf up or something.
Being home with family and friends, that's it. I am a great fan of doing nothing, actually. Absolutely. Like holidays. I'll go off and look at Roman ruins and all that, but I'm not into skiing. People go on about skiing and I just think, but it's your holiday. Why are you
going to the gym, but with snow?
Yeah. It's cold. Don't go when it's cold. And also, you can hurt yourself really badly. And, you know, most of you I've spoken to have.
Yes.
You know, they say, oh, I pulled my hamstring. I managed to get 4 days in, though, so it was great. No, it wasn't. That sounds horrible.
What would you do? What's your holiday?
I'm cold and in pain. Stop it. I'm paying for this.
So do you go somewhere hot for your holidays?
We like sort of beach holidays and, you know, interesting. We'll do kind of like a week in somewhere interesting and then a week somewhere to flop. I've nearly been killed twice on holiday. Having said, I don't go skiing. There was the hippo.
Yes.
The other was on the bottom of the ocean when I was, there was a thing, it was a sort of scuba diving thing they did, but it was you were connected to the boat by a very kind of Victorian looking Jules Verne kind of diving metal
bell, yes,
diving bell helmet that was pumping air into you, and that you had a lead
was this sort of 18th century?
No, the idea was it wasn't very deep, and you went to the seabed, which was, you know, it was about, I don't know, 8 meters below, but you walked along and then there was lots of coral, but lots of fish, tropical fish, and you held out little bits of cake and stuff, and the fish would all feed.
They love sponge. They absolutely love it.
Custard, which underwater just is a mess. But they loved it. Right, so anyway, and you've got these metal boots, so you sink to that. I had done a bit.
Lead pants.
Lead belt and metal boots, right? And so you're in this diving bell, pumping air, so you're connected to the thing. And a scuba diver comes down with you to make sure everything's fine. And I had done a little bit of scuba diving before, which was fine. So I wasn't, you know, fazed by that. However, the air supply to the diving bell wasn't working. And so actually my helmet, my metal glass helmet, just started filling with water. And I was running out of oxygen. And what I didn't appreciate was when you run out of oxygen, you don't go, excuse me, I'm running out of oxygen. Because the oxygen supply is not getting to your brain, you're actually going, oh, I think I'm running out of oxygen, but
I don't care.
I don't know. We'll sort something out, I'm sure. Oh, I can't even be bothered now saying I'm running out of oxygen. I think I'll go to sleep. And so that's what happens. But fortunately, the other scuba diver saw what was going on, i.e. my helmet was full of water. And I could just remember his like huge kind of like fearful look in his eyes as he thought, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he turned a valve and then the oxygen came in and the water poured out. So I nearly died.
Holidays are not good for you.
Jules Verne type suit at the bottom of the sea.
Because it's not like you can just come up for air because you're wearing lead.
No, I couldn't get up. No, I know.
Heavy shoes. Plus your hands are weighed down with custard.
I did this Channel 4 show, the Omani Nushi shows, and for publicity they wanted me to be underwater, but sitting in a barber's chair and having my hair cut.
Of course.
But all underwater.
Mm.
And I thought that was fine because I get, you know, I've done the scuba diving. So we did that. And again, we're in, what do you call it? The suit.
The wetsuit.
The wetsuit.
Yeah.
And then my clothes, as it were. And then the metal. And then there's someone else there So you're not connected to any oxygen. There's someone there who gives you the tank to take a deep breath in.
And then
you release. And then you kind of pause for like until basically you run out of breath. And then you make a signal and then they give you some more. And that was fine. And we spent like all day at the bottom of this. And it was bizarre because it was at someone's house in sort of Ealing. You went through their house into their back garden.
Into an enormous deep pool.
And it's there really to shoot, you know, like underwater cameras and things like that, for photo shoots for that sort of specialist kind of camera equipment. But they did say that sometimes really harassed businessmen book in an hour just to kind of sit at the bottom when no one can get them. Can you imagine what that must be like?
Oh,
you know,
man,
so stressed, I'm going to drive to Ealing to someone's house.
Someone's very deep swimming
and
pool.
Just sit at the bottom of a pool for like
with
2 or 3 hours.
With a metal belt
really.
On.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with a man giving you oxygen when you give the thumbs up. Yeah. Or do they have their own oxygen?
I think they had their own oxygen. So they could just sit at the bottom where no one, absolutely no one, can get hold of them.
That is almost the perfect metaphor for the modern age.
Yeah.
That's as bad as we've got now. I might need that address, though, in Ealing. If you could just write it on the back of an envelope.
Yeah. Your neighbour is building a small but deep pool, you know there's trouble.
Thanks for listening. As always, you can post reviews at Apple Podcasts. You can post abuse to my Twitter feed at Sue Perkins. All are welcome. All the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith, and if you want to check out more Waiting for Smith, then go to Spotify.
When the mob has turned to clay, and the people have all turned grey, and the Romans don't walk so slow, I'll be there if you want me to. I'll be there if you want me to. Oh, it's fair to say I'll be there every day.